The wind had dropped, and the sea was calm, but the sky was still black from the billowing clouds. There wasn't a single trace of Alcyone.
Not even a trace was left, Jarl. Well, tiny pieces of rigging, some rags, nothing more.
Asa Thiazi interrupted his tale, watching the sun vanishing beyond Spikarug's wooded peaks. Krach and Krait, lost in thought, didn't hurry him.
We know not, Asa Thiazi finally continued, how many managed to jump before Alcyone was sucked into that devilish cloud. But no matter how many jumped, none survived. And we, though we spared neither time nor strength, fished out but two bodies. Two bodies born on the water. Only two.
Was the sorceress, the Jarl asked in an altered voice, not among them?
No.
Krach and Krait was silent a long while. The sun was completely hidden behind Spikarug.
Old Guthlaf, son of Sven, is lost.
Asa Thiazi spoke again. The crabs on the bottom of the abyss have surely ate him till the last little bone.
And the witch is certainly lost. Jarl, folk are beginning to talk that it's all her fault and punishment for her crimes. Foolish nonsense!
She's perished, Asa muttered,
in the Sidnar Abyss, in the same place as Pavetr and Duni did back then. It was an accident.
It was no accident,
Krach and Krait said with conviction.
It was certainly no accident then, and nor was it now.
It is proper for a hapless one to suffer. His pain and humiliation result from the laws of nature, and to carry out the aims of nature, both the existence of the suffering one is necessary, as is that of those who, causing him suffering, enjoy their successes. That very truth ought to stifle the pang of conscience in the heart of a tyrant or malefactor. He must not bridle himself. He ought to commit all the deeds that arise in his imagination, since it is the voice of nature which suggests them. If the secret inspirations of nature lead us to evil, it is evidently essential to nature. Donatien, Alphonse François de Sade. Chapter 10. The clank and thud of the cell door, first opening and then closing, awoke the younger of the two Skara sisters. The elder was sitting at a table, busy scraping dried porridge from the bottom of a tin bowl.
Well, how was it in court, Kenna?
Without a word, Joanna Selborne, also known as Kenna, sat down on her plank bed with her elbows resting on her knees and her forehead on her hands. The younger Skara yawned, belched and farted loudly. Gurwood, crouching on the opposite bed, muttered something indistinct and turned his head away. He was furious at Kenna, the sisters, and the whole world. In normal jails, the inmates were still traditionally separated according to sex. In military citadels, it was different. Emperor Fergus Var Emrys, confirming women's equality in the Imperial Army by special decree, had already ruled that if it was to be emancipation, then let it be emancipation. Equality ought to be complete and outright, without any exceptions or special privileges for either sex. Since then, inmates had been serving time in mixed cells in the strongholds and citadels.
Well, the older Skara repeated, are they letting you out?
Like hell they are,
said Kenna bitterly, head still resting on her hands.
I'll be lucky if they don't hang me.
Sod it! I told the truth, hid nothing.
Well, you know, almost nothing. But when those horsens started grilling me, first they made a fool out of me in front of everyone. Then it turned out I wasn't a credible person, but a criminal element. And right at the end, they brought out my complicity in a plot aimed at subversion with the aim of an insurrection.
Subversion?
The older Skara nodded, as though she understood exactly what it was about.
Ah, if it's subversion, then you're in the shit, Kenner.
As if I didn't know that.
The younger Skara stretched, yawned like a leopard, widely and noisily, jumped down from the upper bunk, vigorously kicked away Kohut's stool, which was blocking her way, and spat on the floor beside it. Kohut growled, but didn't dare do anything more. Kohut was mortally offended by Kenna, but was afraid of the sisters. When Kenna had been assigned to the cell 3 days earlier, it soon turned out that Kohut, if he tolerated the emancipation and equality of women at all, had his own views on the subject. He had thrown a blanket over Kenna's upper half in the middle of the night and intended to avail himself of the lower half, which he certainly would have done, but for the fact that he had happened upon a teleempathic. Kenna penetrated his brain so deeply that Kohut howled like a werewolf and cavorted around the cell as though bitten by a tarantula. Then, out of pure vindictiveness, Kenna telepathically forced him to go down on all fours and bang his head rhythmically against the metal-plated cell door. When the warders, alarmed by the dreadful thumping, opened the door, Kohut butted one of them, for which he received 5 lashes with a metal-tipped truncheon and as many kicks. Summing up, Kohut didn't get the gratification he'd been hoping for, and took offence at Kenna. He didn't even dare to take his revenge, because the next day the Skara sisters joined them in the cell. The fair sex thus formed the majority, and furthermore, it soon turned out that the sisters' views on equality were similar to Kohut's, if completely the other way around, concerning the roles ascribed to the sexes. The younger Skara looked at the man lasciviously and made explicit comments, while the older cackled and rubbed her hands together. As a result, Kohut slept with a stool with which he planned to defend his honour. Nonetheless, his chances and prospects were meagre. Both Skaras had served on the front line and were veterans of numerous battles, so would not have been daunted by the stool. Had they wanted to rape him, they would have, even if the man had been armed with a battle axe. Kenna, though, was certain the sisters were only joking. Well, almost certain. The Skara sisters were in the slammer for assaulting an officer, while in the case of Kohut, who had served as a quartermaster, an investigation was ongoing into a notorious major scandal regarding the theft of army bows, which was creating ever-widening ripples.
"In the shit, Kenna," the older Skara repeated. "You've got yourself in a fine pickle. Or rather, they got you into it. How come you never bloody caught on it was a political game?"
"Humph." Skara glanced at her, not quite knowing how to interpret her monosyllabic response. Kenna looked away. "I'm not going to tell you something I kept quiet about in front of the judges, am I?" she thought. "That I knew what kind of game I was getting tangled up in, or when and how I found out."
"You've landed yourself in a sorry mess," said the younger Skara solemnly.
She was the much more dull-witted one, who, Kenna was certain, understood nothing of what it was about.
"And what finally happened with that Sintran princess?"
the older Skara kept probing.
"I mean, you finally nabbed her, didn't you?"
"We did, if you could call it that. What's the date today?"
"September the 22nd. It's the equinox tomorrow."
"Ah, well, that's a queer coincidence. Tomorrow, it'll be a year to the day since those events." "A year already." Kenna stretched out on her pallet, hands clasped behind her head. The sisters remained silent, hoping it had been an introduction to a story. "Nothing doing, sisters dear," thought Kenna, looking at the obscene drawings and even more obscene comments scrawled on the planks of the upper bunk. "There won't be any story. It's not even that that bastard Kohut smells like a bloody narc. I just don't feel like talking about it. I don't feel like remembering it. What happened a year ago, after Bonnard gave us the slip in Clermont? We'd arrived there 2 days too late," she recalled. "The trail had already gone cold. No one knew where the bounty hunter had gone. No one apart from the merchant Hoovenagel, that is. But Hoovenagel didn't want to talk to Skellen or even have him in the house. He communicated through his servants that he had no time and wouldn't grant them an audience. Tawny Owl was cross and indignant, but what could he do? It was ebbing. He didn't have the necessary jurisdiction. And we could do nothing about Hoovenagel any other way. I mean, our way. For he had a private army down in Clermont, and we couldn't exactly declare war." Boreas Munn sniffed around. Dacre Siliphant and Ola Harsheim tried bribery. Till Ekrada, elven magic. I used telepathy and listened to his thoughts, but it wasn't much use. All we learned was that Barnard had left the town through the southern gate. But before he left... In Claremont, there was a tiny little temple with larches by the southern gate and the small marketplace. Before leaving Claremont, Barnard had cruelly beaten Falca with a knout in the square in front of the temple. Before everybody's eyes, including the temple priests. He yelled that he'd prove to her who her lord and master was. That he was flogging her with a knout as he wished, and if he so wished, he'd flog her to death. Because no one would stand up for her. No one would come to her aid. Neither people nor gods. The younger Skara was looking out of the window, hanging onto the grating. The older one was eating porridge from the bowl. Coad took the stool, lay down and covered himself with a blanket. The bell in the guardhouse tolled. The guards on the walls yelled out their presence. Kenna turned her face to the wall. "We met several days later," she thought. "Me and Bonnard, face to face." I looked into his inhuman, fish-like eyes, thinking only of one thing, how he'd beaten the girl. And I looked into his thoughts, for a moment, and it was like sticking my head into a dug-up grave. That was at the equinox. And the day before, the 22nd of September, I'd realized that an invisible spy had wormed his way among us. Stefan Skellen, the Imperial Coroner, listened without interrupting, but Kenna saw his face changing.
"Again, Selborn," he drawled. "Say it again, for I don't believe my own ears."
"Cautiously, my Lord Coroner," she murmured. "Pretend to be angry. That I've come to you with a request, and you won't grant it. For the sake of appearances, I mean. I'm not mistaken, I'm certain. An unseen guest has been hanging around us for 2 days. An invisible spy."
Tawny Owl, to give him his due, was clever and understood at once. "No, Selborn, I refuse," he said loudly, but without over-dramatizing his tone or expression. "Discipline applies to everyone. There are no exceptions."
"Please, at least listen, Lord Coroner."
Kenna didn't have Tawny Owl's talent, failed to avoid awkwardness, but in the scene being played out, awkwardness and embarrassment by the petitioner were permissible.
"Please, at least see fit as to listen."
"Speak, Selborn, but be brief and to the point."
"He's been spying on us for 2 days," she muttered, pretending she was humbly presenting her argument. "Since Claremont. He has to ride behind us secretively, and when we're camped, he approaches unseen, moves around among people, and listens."
"He listens, the sodding spy." Skellen didn't have to pretend to be stern and angry. The fury was trembling in his voice. "How did you uncover him?"
"Yesterday, when you were giving Lord Siliphant his orders outside the tavern, the tomcat, sleeping on the bench, hissed and flattened its ears. It seemed suspicious to me because there wasn't anyone on that side. And then I picked up something, a thought, kind of, an unfamiliar thought and will. When there are familiar, ordinary thoughts all around, an unfamiliar thought like that, Lord Coroner, is as if someone were shouting. I started taking heed intensely. I doubled my efforts, and now I can sense him."
"Can you always sense him?"
"No, not always. He has some kind of magical protection. I only sense him from very close, and even then, not every time. So I have to be vigilant, because I never know if he's not hiding nearby."
"Just don't scare him away," Tawny Owl muttered. "Don't scare him away. I want him alive, Selborn. What do you suggest?"
"We'll give him the pancake treatment."
"The pancake treatment?
Quiet, Lord Coroner."
"But..." "Oh, never mind. Very well. I'm giving you a free hand.
Tomorrow, make sure we stop and billet in some village or other. I'll sort out the rest. And now, for the sake of appearances, give me a dressing down and I'll go away."
"I can't, really." He smiled at her with his eyes and winked slightly, immediately assuming the overbearing air of a stern commander. "For I'm pleased with you, Miss Selborn."
He said Miss. Miss Selborn, as though to an officer.
He winked again. "No," he said, and brandished an arm, playing his role splendidly. "Request denied. Dismissed."
"Yes, sir."
The next day, in the late afternoon, Skellen ordered his soldiers to make camp in a village by the River Leet. The village was prosperous, ringed by a palisade, and they rode in through a fine gate of freshly cut pine palings. The name of the village was Unicorn, and it took its name from its small stone temple, inside which there was a straw effigy of a unicorn.
"I remember," Kenna recalled, "how we laughed at that straw idol, and the village headman gravely explained that the sacred unicorn which looked after the village had many years before been made of gold, then silver, then copper. There were several versions in bone and several in hardwood, but all of them had been stolen. People came from far away to rob or steal it. Things had only been peaceful since the unicorn had been made of straw. We set up camp in the village. As agreed, Skelen occupied the headman's hall. Less than an hour later, we'd given the spy the pancake treatment, in classic textbook fashion."
"Please come closer," Tawny Owl ordered loudly. "Please come closer and take a look at this document. Hold on. Is everybody here? So I won't have to explain twice."
Ola Harsheim, who had just taken a sip of cream somewhat watered down with sour milk from a milking pail, licked the creamy moustache from his lips, put down the vessel, looked around and counted. Dacre Siliphant, Bert Brigden, Neratin Seker, Till Ikrada, Joanna Selborne.
"The Fietze is not here. Summon him. Creel? Duffy Creel? To the commander for the briefing. To receive important orders. At a double."
Duffy Creel ran into the hall out of breath.
"Everybody's here, Lord Coroner," Ola Harsheim reported. "Leave the window open. We could expire from the smell of garlic in here. Open the door, too. Make a draft."
Brigden and Creel obediently opened the window and the door. Kenna, meanwhile, thought once again that Tawny Owl would make a really splendid actor.
"Please step this way, gentlemen. I've received this document from the Emperor, confidential and of extraordinary gravity. Your attention, please."
"Now!"
yelled Kenna, sending a powerful directional impulse whose effect on the senses was similar to being struck by lightning. Ola Harsheim and Dacre Siliphant picked up the milk pail and simultaneously flung the cream in the direction Kenna was indicating. Till Ikrada vigorously emptied a flour barrel which had been hidden under the table. A creamy, flowery shape, amorphous at first, appeared on the floor of the chamber. But Bert Brigden was alert. Correctly judging where the pancake's head might be, he whacked it as hard as he could with a cast-iron frying pan. Then everybody threw themselves at the spy, who was plastered all over with cream and flour, tore the hat of invisibility from his head, and seized his arms and legs. After upturning the table, they tied the captive's limbs to the legs. They pulled off his boots and foot wraps and stuffed one of them into his mouth, which was open and ready to shout. In order to crown their work, Dufizi Creel kicked the captive hard in the ribs, and the others took pleasure in watching the spy's eyes bulge out of their sockets.
"Magnificent work," commented Tawny Owl, who hadn't moved during the entire brief incident, but had stood with his arms crossed on his chest. "Bravo! Congratulations! Above all to you, Miss Selborne."
"Bloody hell," thought Kenna. "If it carries on like this, I really am liable to end up an officer."
Mr. Brigden,
Stefan Skelen said coldly, standing over the prisoner, spread out between the table legs.
"Put the irons in the coals, please. Mr. Ikrada, please make sure no children are hanging around outside."
He leaned over and looked into the bound man's eyes.
"You haven't shown your face for ages, Ryans," he said. "I was beginning to think some misfortune had befallen you."
The bell in the guardhouse, the signal for the changing of the guard, struck. The Skara sisters snored euphoniously. Kohut, hugging the stool, smacked his lips in his sleep.
"He played the hero," Kenna recalled, "pretending to be brave, that foolhardy Ryans."
The sorcerer, Ryans, given the pancake treatment and tied to the legs of a table with his bare feet sticking up.
He was playing the hero, but wasn't fooling anybody, least of all me.
Tawny Owl warned us he was a sorcerer, so I scrambled his thoughts to stop him casting spells or sending for magical help, and read his thoughts while I was about it. He was blocking my way in, but when he caught a whiff of the smoke from the coal of the brazier where the irons were heating up, his magical protection and blockades burst along all their seams like old breeches, and I was able to read him freely. His thoughts didn't differ from those of other people I've read in like situations. The thoughts of people who are about to be tortured. Chaotic,
trembling thoughts, full of fear and despair. Cold, slimy, wet, foul-smelling thoughts, like a corpse's entrails. In spite of that, when the gag was removed, the sorcerer Ryans tried to play the hero.
Well, well, Skellen, you've caught me, you win. Congratulations. A deep bow to your technique, expertise and professionalism. Splendidly trained operatives. Truly, it's enviable. And now please release me from this unseemly position.
Tawny Owl drew up a chair and straddled it, resting his clasped fingers and chin on the backrest. He looked down at the captive and said nothing.
Have me released, Skellen,
Ryans repeated, and then order your subordinates to leave. What I have to say is meant for your ears only.
Mr. Brigden, Tawny Owl said, without turning his head, what colour are the irons?
A bit longer, sir.
Miss Selborne?
I'm having difficulty reading him now, Kenna shrugged. He's too afraid. The fear's drowning out all other thoughts, and there are lots of those thoughts, including a few he's trying to hide, behind magical screens. But it's not hard. I can...
That won't be necessary. We'll try the classic method, a red-hot iron.
Bloody hell! The spy howled. Skellen, you surely don't mean...
Tawny Owl leaned over, his face a little changed.
First, it's Mr. Skellen, he hissed. Secondly, yes, absolutely, I plan to order your soul scorched, Ryans. I shall do it with the utmost satisfaction, for I shall treat it as an expression of historical justice. I'll wager you don't understand.
Ryans remained silent, so Skellen continued.
You see, Ryans, I advised Vathier de Rideau to scorch your heels back then, 7 years ago, when you were fawning to the Imperial Intelligence Service like a cur, begging for mercy and the privilege to be a traitor and a double agent. I repeated that advice 4 years ago when you shamelessly kissed Emir's ass, mediating in contacts with Vilgefortz. When, during the hunt for the Sintran wench, you were promoted from a humble little turncoat to being virtually first resident spy, I wagered Vathier that when burned, you'd say who you serve. No, I've got that wrong.
That you'd name everyone you serve, and everyone you betray. And then I said, you'll see, you'll be astonished, Vathier, how many points on the two lists correspond. But well, Vathier de Rideau didn't listen to me, and now surely regrets it. But nothing's lost. I'll only toast you a little, and when I know what I want to know, I shall leave you to Vatier's disposal. And he'll flay you, slowly, one piece at a time.
Tawny Owl removed a handkerchief and a vial of perfume from his pocket. He sprinkled the perfume liberally on the handkerchief and pressed it to his nose. The perfume smelled pleasant, but nonetheless, Kenna felt like vomiting.
The iron, Mr. Brigden.
I'm tracking you on Vilgefortz's orders, Ryans roared. It concerns the girl. By tracking your troop, I hope to get ahead of you. Reach that bounty hunter before you did. I was going to try to negotiate the wench away from him. From him, not from you. Because you want to kill her, and Vilgefortz needs her alive. What else do you want to know? I'll tell you. I'll tell you everything.
Whoa there, Tawny Owl called. Not so fast. Why, a fellow's head could ache from such a racket and mass of information. Can you imagine, gentlemen, what will happen when we burn him? He'll scream us to death.
Creel and Siliphant cackled raucously. Kenna and Naratin Saker didn't join in the merriment. Neither did Bert Brigden, who had just then removed the iron from the coals and was examining it critically. The iron was so hot it seemed to be transparent, as though it wasn't iron, but a glass tube full of molten fire. Ryans saw it and shrieked,
I know how to find the bounty hunter and the girl, he yelled. I know. I'll tell you.
I'm certain of that.
Kenna, still trying to read his thoughts, grimaced, picking up a wave of desperate, impotent fury. Something snapped in Ryan's brain, yet another partition.
He'll say something out of fear, thought Kenna. Something he meant to keep until the end as a trump card, an ace, which would have beaten all the other aces in a last deciding hand for the highest stakes. Now he'll discard that ace out of a banal, revolting fear of pain.
Suddenly,
Something popped in her head, and she felt heat in her temples, and then suddenly cold. And she knew. She knew Ryance's hidden thought. "By the gods," she thought, "what a pickle I'm in."
"I'll talk,"
howled the sorcerer, reddening and staring goggle-eyed in the coroner's face.
"I'll tell you something genuinely important, Skellen. That here Dorito."
Kenna suddenly heard another thought belonging to someone else. She saw Naratin Seka, with a hand on his dagger, moving towards the door. Boots pounded, and Boreas Munn rushed into the headman's hall.
"My lord coroner, quickly, sir. You'll never believe who's here."
Skellen gestured to Brigden, who was bending over towards the spy's heels with the iron, to stop.
"You ought to play the lottery, Ryance," he said, looking out of the window. "I've never met anyone in my life with such luck."
Through the window, they could see a crowd and two people on horseback in the midst of it. Kenna knew at once who it was. She knew who the bony giant was, with the pale, fish-like eyes, riding a powerful bay. And who the ashen-haired girl on the splendid black mare was, with hands bound and a collar around her neck, and a bruise on her swollen cheek. Visigota returned to his cottage in a foul mood, dejected, taciturn, even angry. The reason was a conversation with a peasant who had rowed over in a dugout canoe to collect some pelts. "Perhaps for the last time before the spring," said the peasant. "The weather is getting worse by the day. The rain and wind are so bad I'm afraid to venture onto the water. Ice on the puddles in the morning, blizzards are nigh, and after that frosts. The river will rise in the flood at any time. Then it's away with the dugout and out with the sleigh. But even a sleigh's no use on periplot, nor but bogs as far as the eye can see."
The peasant was right. Towards the evening, it became overcast, and white flakes fell from the dark blue sky. A stiff easterly wind flattened the dry reeds, whipping up white crests over the surface of the wetland. It had become piercingly, bitterly cold. "The day after tomorrow," thought Visigota, "is the Feast of Samhain. According to the elven calendar, it'll be the new year in 3 days. According to the human calendar, we'll have to wait another 2 months." Kelpie, Ciri's black mare, stamped and snorted in the barn. When he entered the cottage, he found Ciri rummaging around in his chests. He let her, even encouraged her. Firstly, it was quite a new activity, after riding Kelpie and leafing through books. Secondly, there were plenty of his daughter's things in the chests, and the girl needed warm clothing. Several changes of clothing, for in the cold and damp, it took many days before the laundry finally dried. Ciri was selecting, trying on, putting aside and discarding various items of clothing. Visigota was sitting at the table. He ate 2 boiled potatoes and a chicken wing, in silence.
"Good workmanship." She showed him some objects he hadn't seen in years, and had even forgotten he had. "Did these also belong to your daughter? Was it a hobby of hers?"
"Yes, she loved it. She couldn't wait for the winter."
"Can I take them?"
"Take what you want," he shrugged. "They're of no use to me, if they'll come in handy, and if the boots fit. But are you packing, Ciri? Are you preparing to go?"
She fixed her eyes on the pile of clothing.
"Yes, Visigota," she said after a brief silence. "I've decided, because, you see, there's no time to lose."
"Your dreams?"
"Yes," she admitted a moment later. "I saw very unpleasant things in my dreams. I'm not certain if they've taken place or are yet to happen. I have no idea if I can prevent it. But I must go. You see, once I felt aggrieved that the people closest to me didn't come to my aid, left me at the mercy of fate. But now I think they're the ones that need my help. I have to go."
"Winter's coming."
"That's precisely why I must go. If I stay, I'll be stuck here until spring. Until the spring, I'll be fretting in idleness and uncertainty, plagued by nightmares. I have to go right now to try to find the Tower of the Swallow, that teleporter. You worked out it'll take me a fortnight to reach the lake. I'd be there before the November full moon."
"You can't leave your hideout now," he said with effort. "Not now. They'll capture you. Ciri, your pursuers, they are very close. You cannot now."
She threw a blouse down onto the floor and sprang up.
"You've learned something?"
she said sharply. "From the peasant who took the pelts. Tell me."
"Siri,
tell me, please."
He told her. He was later to regret it.
"The devil must have sent them, good Sir Hermit," mumbled the peasant, breaking off from counting the pelts. "Must have been the devil. They've been galloping through the forest since the equinox, searching for some maid. Frightening folk, yelling and threatening, but always riding on, never tarrying long enough to do too much harm. But now they've thought up something new. In some villages and settlements, they've left some, what were it? Scent trees? They ain't no trees, good sir, scent or otherwise, just simply three or four good-for-nothing scoundrels, naught but trouble. They say they're going to lie in wait the whole winter to see if the maid they're hunting doesn't creep out of some hidey hole and venture into the village. Then that tree's supposed to nab her."
"Are they in your village too?"
The peasant's face darkened and he ground his teeth.
"Not in our village. We was lucky. But in Dundara, half a day from us, there's four. They're quartered in the inn. Scoundrels, good Sir Hermit. Damned scoundrels. Rogues. They took their pleasure with the village wenches, and when the menfolk stood up to them, they killed them, good sir, without mercy. Killed them, dead. They killed people, two, the headman and one other. And is there a punishment for such ne'er-do-wells, good sir? And is there a lore? There's no punishment or lore. A carter who came to Dundara with his wife and daughter, he said that years ago there used to be witches in the world, so they say. They dealt with every kind of villainy. We ought to send a witcher to Dundara. He'd give those rascals short shrift. Witchers killed monsters, not people. They're knaves, good Sir Hermit, not people. Naught but knaves from hell. A witch is what's needed for them, no more, no less. Well, time I were going, good Sir Hermit. Ooh, winter's coming. Soon it'll be away with the dugout and out with the sleigh. And what them knaves from Dundara need, good sir, is a witcher.
"Oh, that's right," Ciri repeated through clenched teeth. "Oh, absolutely right. A witcher's what they need. Or a witcher girl. Four, is it? In Dundara, they say. And where is bloody Dundara? Upstream? Would I get there across the tussocks?"
"By the gods, Ciri," Visigotta said in terror. "You can't seriously be thinking.
Don't swear by the gods if you don't believe in them. And I know you don't.
Let's leave my views out of this. Ciri, what infernal ideas are you hatching? How can you even..."
"Now you leave my convictions alone, Visigotta. I know what I have to do. I'm a witcher."
"You're an unstable young person," he exploded. "You're a child who's been through traumatic experiences. A damaged child on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And more than that, you're sick with a craving for revenge. Blinded by a lust for retribution. Don't you understand that?"
"I understand it better than you," she yelled, "because you have no idea what it means to be hurt. You have no idea about revenge, for no one has ever truly wronged you." She rushed out of the cottage. A bitterly cold draught briefly blew through the hallway and the main room before she slammed the door shut. Soon after, he heard neighing and the pounding of hooves. Agitated, he banged the plate down onto the table.
"Let her go," he thought angrily. "Let her shake off the anger."
It wasn't as if he was afraid for her. She'd ridden often enough among the bogs, by day and night. She knew the paths, causeways, tussocks and meadows. If, though, she did get lost, she'd only have to let go of the reins. Her black kelpie knew the way home to the goat's barn. Some time after, when it was already very dark, he went out and hung the lantern on a post. He stood by the fence and listened out for the clatter of hooves or the splash of water. But the wind and the rustling of the reeds muffled all sound. The lantern on the post swayed crazily until it finally went out. And then he heard it. From far away. No, not from the direction Ciri had ridden towards, but on the other side, from the bogs. A savage, inhuman, long-drawn-out, plaintive cry. A howl. A moment of silence. And again. A banshee, an elven phantom, the harbinger of death. Visigotta trembled from cold and from fear.
He quickly headed back towards the cottage, muttering and humming under his breath, so as not to hear it at all, because he must not hear it. Kelpie emerged from the darkness before he managed to relight the lantern.
"Go into the cottage," Ciri said gently and softly, "and don't leave. It's a foul night."
They bickered again over supper.
"You seem to know a great deal about the problems of good and evil."
"Because I do, and not from scholarly books either."
"No, of course. You know it all from experience, from practice, for you've acquired plenty of experience in your long 16 years of life."
"I've gained enough, quite enough."
"Congratulations, my learned friend."
"You can sneer," she clenched her teeth, "without having any idea how much evil you've done to the world. You aged scholars, you theoreticians with your books, with your centuries-old experience of reading moral treatises so diligently you didn't even have time to look out of the window to see what the world was really like. You philosophers, artificially shoring up artificial philosophies in order to earn salaries at universities. And since not a soul would pay you for the ugly truth about the world, you invented ethics and morality. Nice, optimistic sciences. Except they're fallacious and deceitful.
There's nothing more deceitful than a half-baked judgment, miss. Than a hasty and incautious conclusion.
You didn't find a remedy for evil. But I, a callow witcher, have an infallible remedy."
He didn't respond, but his face must have betrayed him, because Ciri leapt up from the table.
"Do you think I'm talking nonsense, making wild claims?"
"I think," he calmly replied, "you're speaking in anger. I think you're planning your revenge in anger. And I strongly urge you to calm down."
"I am calm. And revenge? Answer me. Why not? Why should I eschew revenge? In the name of what? Higher reasons? And what's higher than an order of things where evil deeds are punished? To you, O philosopher and ethicist, revenge is an improper deed, reprehensible, unethical, and ultimately unlawful. And I ask, where is the punishment for evil? Who should attest it, adjudge it, and inflict it? The gods you don't believe in? The great demiurge creator you've decided to replace the gods with? Or perhaps the law? Perhaps Nilfgaardian justice, imperial judgments, prefects? You naive old man."
"And so it's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, blood for blood, and for that blood, more blood, a sea of blood? Do you want to drown the world in blood, oh naive, damaged girl? Is that how you mean to fight evil, little witcher?"
"Yes, just like that. For I know what evil fears. Not your ethics, Visigotha, not sermons, not moral treatises about a worthy life. Evil fears pain, impairment, suffering, death, the end. When wounded, evil howls with pain like a dog. It rolls around on the floor and squeals, watching the blood spurt from its veins and arteries, seeing its bones stick out of stumps, seeing its guts crawl from its belly, sensing that with the cold, death is approaching. Then, and only then, does evil's hair stand on end, and evil finally yell, 'Mercy! I repent of my sins! I'll be good and decent now, I swear! Just save me! Staunch the blood! Don't let me perish ignominiously!' Yes, O hermit, that's how you fight evil. If evil wants to do you harm, inflict pain on you, anticipate it, ideally when evil isn't expecting it. If, though, you didn't manage to anticipate evil, if you were harmed by evil, then pay it back. Catch it. Ideally, when it has forgotten, when it feels safe. Pay it back twofold, threefold. An eye for an eye? No. Both eyes for an eye. A tooth for a tooth? No. All its teeth for a tooth. Pay evil back. Make it howl with pain so its eyeballs burst from its howling. And then, looking down at the floor, you may confidently say, 'What's lying there won't harm anybody any longer. It won't threaten anyone. For how can it threaten anyone without any eyes, if it has no hands? How can it do any harm when its guts are trailing over the sand and the gore is soaking into it?'"
"And you," the hermit said slowly, "stand with your bloodied sword in hand
and look at the blood soaking into the sand. And you have the audacity to think that the age-old dilemma has been solved, the philosopher's dream has been attained? You think the nature of evil has been transformed?
I do, she said defiantly, because what's lying on the ground with blood gushing from it is no longer evil. Perhaps it isn't yet good, but it certainly isn't evil anymore.
They say, Visigoth said slowly, that nature abhors a vacuum. Whatever is lying on the ground, bleeding profusely, whatever died from your sword, is no longer evil. What is it, then? Have you ever thought about that?
No, I'm a witcher. When they were teaching me, I swore I would act against evil, always, and without thinking. Because when you start thinking, she added hollowly, killing stops making sense. Revenge stops making sense. And you can't let that happen.
He shook his head, but she gestured to him to stop arguing.
It's time I finished my story, Visigotha. I've been unfolding it for you for 30 nights, from the equinox to Samhain. But I haven't told you everything. Before I leave, you have to learn what happened on the day of the equinox in the village called Unicorn.
She groaned when he pulled her from the saddle. The hip he had kicked her in the day before was hurting. He tugged on the chain attached to the collar and pulled her towards a light-coloured building. Several armed men were standing in the doorway, and one tall woman.
Bonart, said one of the men, slim and brown-haired, with a thin face, holding a brass-tipped knout. It has to be said that you are full of surprises. Greetings, Skellen.
The man addressed as Skellen looked her straight in the eye for some time. She trembled under his gaze.
Well?
He addressed Bonart again.
Will you explain at once, or perhaps bit by bit? I don't like explaining things in the courtyard, for you get a mouthful of flies. May we go inside?
By all means. Bonhart yanked the chain. Another man was waiting in the main room. He was disheveled and pale, and was probably the cook, because he was busy cleaning traces of flour and cream from his clothing. His eyes lit up at the sight of Ciri. He came closer. He wasn't the cook. She recognized him at once, remembered those hideous eyes and the ugly mark on his face. He was the one who had pursued her on Thaneth with the squirrels. She'd escaped him by jumping out of a window, and he had ordered the elves to jump after her. What had that elf called him? Rents?
Well, well, he said mordantly, jabbing a finger hard and painfully into her breast. Miss Ciri, we haven't seen each other since Thaneth. I've been looking for you a long, long time, miss, and I finally found you.
I don't know, sir, who you are, Bonart said coldly. But what you've claimed to find is actually mine, so keep your mitts off if you value your fingers.
My name's Ryance.
The sorcerer's eyes flashed unpleasantly.
Kindly condescend to commit that to memory, Mr. Bounty Hunter, sir, and who I am will soon be revealed. Whom the maid belongs to will also soon be revealed. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. For now, I want to give her my regards and make a pledge. You don't have anything against that, I trust.
You are free to trust.
Ryance approached Ciri and looked into her eyes from close up.
Your guardian, the hag Yennefer, he said slowly and scornfully, once fell into disfavor with me. And so when I got my hands on her, I, Ryance, taught her pain. With these hands, with these fingers. And I promised her that should you fall into my hands, princess, I would also teach you pain. With these hands, with these fingers.
Risky, Bonart said softly. You're taking a great risk, Mr. Ryance, or whatever your name is, bothering my little girl and threatening her. She is vengeful, liable to hold it against you. I repeat, keep your hands, fingers, and all other parts of your body well away from her.
Enough,
Skellen cut them off, without taking his curious eyes off Ciri.
"Stop it, Bonart. And you too, Ryans. Calm yourself. I've shown you mercy, but I may change my mind and order you bound to the table legs again. Sit down, both of you. Let's talk like cultured people. Just the three of us, and no one else. For we have, it seems to me, much to talk about. But for now, we'll put the subject of our conversations under guard. Mr. Siliphant?"
"Just guard her well."
Bonart handed Siliphant the end of the chain.
"Guard her with your life."
Kenna stayed on the sidelines. Granted, she wanted to observe the wench whom everybody had recently been talking about, but she felt a strange aversion to pushing in amongst the small crowd surrounding Harsheim and Siliphant, who were taking the mysterious captive over to a post in the courtyard. Everybody was crowding around, jostling, peering. They were even trying to touch her, shove her, pull her. The girl trod stiffly, limping slightly, but held her head high. "He's beaten her," thought Kenna. "But he didn't break her."
"So she must be Falkir.
The maid's barely grown."
"A maid, eh? A cutthroat."
"I heard she slayed 6 men, the brute, in the arena in Claremont."
"Then before that, how many others? The she-devil?"
"She-wolf." "And the mare. What a mare, look. A horse of marvellous blood. And here, by Bonnot's saddle flap, what a sword. Ah, a marvel."
"Leave it alone," Dacre Siliphant growled. "Don't touch. Get your hands off other people's things. Don't touch the girl either. Don't paw her, don't hinder or insult her. Show some charity. We know not that we shan't be executing her before dawn. May she at least know peace until that time."
"If the wench is to go to her death," grinned Cyprian Fripp the younger, "perhaps we could sweeten the remainder of her life and satiate her well, throw her on the hay and bed her."
"Oi," Cabernic Turant cackled. "We could. Let us tune out if it's allowed."
"I tell you it's not allowed,"
Dacre cut them off.
"Nor else occupies your minds, you damned fornicators. I said leave the maid in peace. Andres, Stigwood, stand here by her. Don't take your eyes off her or move a foot away, and use the lash on any that come close."
"Sod that," said Fripp.
"Very well. Makes no difference to us. Let's be off, fellas, to the hay barn and join the villagers. They're roasting a ram and a porker for the banquet. For today is the equinox, a feast, isn't it? While the masters are deliberating, we can make merry."
"Let's go. Take a demijohn from the chest, Dee-Dee. We'll take a drink." "May we, Mr. Siliphant? Mr. Harsheim? It's the feast today, and we shan't be heading anywhere tonight."
"Ah, what droll designs," Siliphant frowned. "They think of naught but feasting and toping. And who will stay here to help guard the wench and wait on Sir Stefan's summons?"
"I shall stay," said Naratin Seker. "And I," said Kenna.
Dacre Siliphant looked at them attentively. Finally, he gestured his assent. Fripp and company roared their thanks incoherently.
"But have a care down there at that merrymaking," Ulla Harsheim warned. "Don't molest any wenches, or you might get jabbed in the privates with a pitchfork."
"Sod that. Come in with us, Chloe. And you, Kenna, won't you think it over?"
"No, I'm staying."
"They left me chained to the post with my hands bound. Two of them were guarding me, and the two standing nearby kept glancing over, watching me. The tall, good-looking woman, and a man with slightly feminine looks and bearing. Odd in some way."
The cat, sitting in the middle of the room, yawned broadly, bored, because the mouse it was tormenting had stopped providing amusement. Visigotha said nothing.
Bonart, Ryance, and that Skellen, Tawny Owl, were still debating in the headman's hall. I didn't know what about. I might have expected the worst, but I was resigned. One more arena? Or would they simply kill me? Blow it, I thought. Let it finally be over.
Visigotha said nothing. Bonart sighed.
"Don't glower, Skellen," he repeated. "I simply wanted to make some money. It's time, you notice, I retired to sit on the porch and watch pigeons. You gave me 100 florins for the she-rat. You badly wanted her dead. That puzzled me. How much could the maid really be worth, I thought. And I worked out that if she were killed or handed over, she would certainly be worth less than if she were kept. an old principle of economics and commerce. Goods like her keep gaining in value. One can always haggle.
Tawny Owl wrinkled his nose as though there was a bad smell in the vicinity.
You're painfully frank, Bonnat, but get to the point, to the explanations. You fled with a girl through the whole of Ebbing, and all of a sudden you show up and start explaining the laws of economics. Tell me what happened.
What is there to explain?
Ryan smiled repellently.
Mr. Bonnat has simply finally grasped who the wench really is and how much she's worth.
Skellen didn't grace him with a glance. He was looking at Bonnat into his fish-like, expressionless eyes.
And he pushes this precious girl, this valuable acquisition meant to guarantee his pension, out into the arena in Claremont, he drawled, and makes her fight to the death. Risks her life, though she's allegedly worth so much alive. What's it about, Bonnat? Because something doesn't add up.
Had she perished in the arena?
Bonnat didn't lower his eyes.
It would have meant she wasn't worth anything.
I see. Tawny Owl frowned slightly. But rather than taking the wench to another arena, you brought her to me. Why, if I might ask?
I repeat, Ryons grimaced. He twigged who she is.
You're shrewd, Lord Ryons.
Bonnat stretched until his joints creaked.
You've guessed right. Yes, it's true that there's one more riddle linked to the witcher girl trained in Kaer Morhen. In Jiso, when the noblewoman was robbed, the wench's tongue wagged that she was apparently so important and titled that the baron's daughter was such small beer and so low-ranking she ought to bow down before her. In that case, this Falker, I think to myself, must at least be the daughter of a count. Curious. Firstly, a witcher girl. Are there so many of them? Secondly, in the rat's gang. Thirdly, the Imperial Coroner is chasing around after her, in person, from Korath to Ebbing, and ordering her killed. And on top of all that, she's a high-born noblewoman. Ah, I think to myself, someone ought to ask that wench who she really is.
He was silent for a time.
At first,
he wiped his nose with his cuff.
She wouldn't talk, although I asked. I asked with hand, foot, and whip. I didn't want to cut her, but, as luck would have it, a barber surgeon turned up, with instruments for extracting teeth. I bound her to a chair.
Skellen swallowed audibly. Ryons smiled. Bonnat studied a cuff.
She told me everything before. As soon as she saw the instruments, those toothed pliers and pincers, she became more forthcoming at once. It turns out she's a
Sintran princess,
said Ryans, looking at Tawny Owl.
The heiress to the throne, a candidate for marriage to Emperor Emir.
Which Lord Skellen didn't deign to tell me,
the bounty hunter sneered.
He ordered me simply to murder her. He stressed it several times. Kill her mercilessly on the spot. Well, Lord Skellen, kill a queen, a emperor's future spouse, with whom, if one is to believe the rumors, the emperor will tie the knot any moment, after which there is to be a general amnesty.
Bonnat glared at Skellen as he delivered his oration. But the Imperial Coroner didn't lower his eyes.
And so, the hunter continued, out it comes. A delicate situation. Thus, though I regret it, I gave up my plans regarding the witcher girl princess. I brought the whole predicament here to Lord Skellen, to talk, to sort things out. For I'd say that this predicament is a little too much for one Bonnat.
A very reasonable conclusion,
said a harsh voice from Ryan's bosom.
Very reasonable, Mr. Bonnat. What you've caught, gentlemen, is a little too much for you both. Luckily, you still have me.
What's that?
Skellen leapt up from his chair. What the bloody hell is that?
My master, the sorcerer Vilgefortz.
Ryons drew from his bosom a tiny silver casket.
More precisely, my master's voice, coming from this magical device. It's called a xenogloss.
Greetings to you all, said the casket. Shame, I can only hear you, but urgent business prevents me from using teleprojection or teleportation.
That's all we bloody need, Tawny Owl snarled, but I might have guessed. Ryons is too stupid to act alone and by himself. I might have guessed you were lurking somewhere in the gloom of Vilgefortz. You lurk in the dark like a fat old spider waiting for your cobweb to quiver.
What a vivid comparison.
Skellen snorted.
And don't try to pull the wool over our eyes, Vilgefortz. You're using Ryans and his casket, not because of the amount of work you have, but from fear of the army of sorcerers, your former comrades in the chapter, who are scanning the whole world in search of traces of magic with your algorithm. Were you to try teleportation, they would locate you in an instant.
What impressive knowledge. We haven't been introduced.
Bonnard bowed quite theatrically before the silver box.
But nevertheless, is the Honorable Ryans promising to torture the girl on your instructions and with your authorization, Master Sorcerer? Am I not mistaken? Upon my word, the girl is becoming more and more important with every moment. It turns out she's necessary to everybody.
We haven't been introduced, Vilgefortz said from the casket. But I know you, Leo Bonnard. You'd be astonished just how well. And the girl is indeed important. After all, she's the lion cub of Sintra, the elder blood. In keeping with Aethelina's prophecy, her descendants will rule over the world in the future.
Why do you need her so much?
I only need her placenta, her womb. Once I've removed it, you can take the rest. What do I hear there? Some kind of snorting? Some kind of disgusted sighing and puffing? Whose? Bonnard's, who physically and psychologically maltreats the girl every day in intricate ways? Or Stefan Skellen's, who intends to kill her on the orders of traitors and plotters? Eh?
I eavesdropped on them, recalled Kenna,
lying on her pallet with her hands behind her head.
I stood around the corner and heard their thoughts. My hair stood on end, over my entire body. All of a sudden, I understood the extent of the predicament I'd got myself into.
Yes, yes, said the voice from the xenogloss. You've betrayed your emperor, Skellen, without hesitation, at the first opportunity.
Tawny Owl snorted disdainfully.
The charge of treachery from the lips of such an arch-traitor as you, Vilgefortz, is indeed a great matter. I'd feel honored if it didn't smack of a cheap, vulgar joke.
I'm not accusing you of treachery, Skellen. I'm mocking your naivety and inability to betray. Who are you betraying your emperor for? For Ardal Epdai and Yvette? Princelings? Their morbid pride piqued? Insulted because the Emperor rejected their young daughters by planning a marriage with the Sintran, whereas they were hoping that a new dynasty would emerge from their families, that their families would become the first in the Empire, that soon they'd rise even higher than the throne. Emir divested them of that hope at one stroke, and then they decided to amend the course of history. They aren't yet ready with an armed rebellion, but they can at least eliminate the girl that Emir chose over their daughters. Of course, they don't feel like sullying their own delicate aristocratic hands. They found a hired thug, Stefan Skellen, suffering from an excess of ambition. Was it like that, Skellen? Don't you want to tell us?
What for? Tawny Owl shouted. And tell whom? As usual, you know everything, don't you, oh great mage? Ryans, as usual, doesn't know anything, and that's as it should be, and Bonnard is unconcerned.
You, though, as I've already demonstrated, don't have anything to boast about. The princes bought you with promises,
but you're too intelligent not to realize that you'll gain nothing with the lordlings. Today, they need you as a tool to eliminate the Sintran. Tomorrow, they'll get rid of you because you're a low-born upstart. Did they offer you Vatier de Rido's position in the new empire? You surely don't believe that, Skellen. They need Vatier more, since secret services always stay the same, coups or not. They only want to murder using your hands, but they need Vatier to take over the security apparatus. Besides, Vatier is a Viscount, and you're a nobody.
Indeed, Tawny Owl pouted. I'm too intelligent not to have noticed that. In that case, I ought in turn to betray Adal Ap Dai and join you, Vilgefortz. Is that what you're driving at? But I'm not a weathercock. If I support the idea of revolution, it's from conviction and principle. Autocratic tyranny ought to be finished, a constitutional monarchy introduced, and after that, democracy. What? The power of the people. A system where the people will rule. The citizenry of all states through the most worthy and honest representatives chosen in an honest election. Ryons roared with laughter. Bonnart laughed wildly. The xenogloss of the mage Vilgefortz laughed heartily, if somewhat screechingly. All three of them laughed and guffawed, weeping great tears.
Very well, Bonnart interrupted the merriment. We haven't gathered here for diversion, but to trade. The girl, for now, doesn't belong to the population of honest citizens of all states. She belongs to me. But I can resell her. What does my Lord Sorcerer have to offer? Does ruling the world interest you? No? Then I shall let you, Vilgefortz said slowly. Be present during what I do to the girl. You'll be able to watch. I know you prefer that kind of voyeurism to all other pleasures.
Bonnard's eyes flashed with white flame, but he was composed.
And more specifically? And more specifically, I'm prepared to pay your fee 20-fold. 2,000 florins. Think, Bonnard. That's a sack of money you won't be able to lift. You're going to need a pack mule. It'll suffice you for your retirement, porch, pigeons, and even for vodka and harlots, if you do it in sensible moderation. Agreed, mage sir.
The hunter laughed, seemingly blithely.
You've touched my heart with that vodka and those harlots. Let's strike a deal. But I'd also be interested in that observation you suggested, too. I'd prefer, admittedly, to watch her expire in the arena, but I'd also be glad to take a look at your knife work. Throw it in as a bonus. Done. That didn't take you long,
Tawny Owl observed sardonically.
In sooth, Vilgefortz, you've struck up a partnership with Bonnart swiftly and smoothly. A partnership which indeed is and will be a Societas Leonina. But might you have forgotten something? The headman's hall where you're sitting and the Sintran you're trading are surrounded by 2 dozen armed soldiers. My soldiers.
My dear Skellen, came Vilgefortz's voice from the box. You insult me by thinking I plan to disadvantage you in the exchange. On the contrary, I mean to be extremely generous. I can't guarantee you, as you deign to call it, democracy, but I guarantee you material assistance, logistical support, and access to information, owing to which you'll stop being a tool and a minion to the conspirators, and will become a partner. One whose person and opinion Prince Joachim de Wet, Duke Ardal Ep Dai, Count Breuner, Count D'Arvi, and all the rest of the blue-blooded plotters will take into account. What if it's a Societas Leonina? Certainly, if Cyrilla is the loot, then I shall take the lion's share. Deservedly so, it seems to me. Does it pain you? After all, you will make a considerable profit.
If you give me the Sintran, Vatier de Rido's position is yours for the taking. And as the head of the Secret Service, Stefan Skellen, one can enact all sorts of utopias, perhaps even democracy and honest elections. So, as you see, I give you the fulfillment of your life's dreams and ambitions in exchange for one skinny 15-year-old. Do you see that?
No. Tawny Owl shook his head. I only hear it.
Ryans?
Yes, Master.
Give Lord Skellen an example of the quality of our information. Tell him what you got out of Vatier.
There's a spy in your troop, said Ryans.
What?
You heard.